This is a rebroadcast of Migrant Matters. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Our guest is Israeli-Canadian independent journalist Leah Tarachansky. Leah is an Israeli-Canadian journalist who has been with the Real News Network since 2008. She is currently finishing up production on Seven Deadly Myths, her debut documentary that is an exploration of the power of collective denial. It questions what Israelis learn, know, and sometimes choose not to know about the 1948 war, the birth of the State of Israel, and the origin of the Palestinian refugee problem. It centers around Israeli veterans of the war and explores both their actions and their memories as part of the Israeli landscape of denial. Leah, welcome to Migrant Matters Radio.
Thank you so much.
What is the Real News?
Well, we're an independent video network, so we do daily news in video, and independent means that we don't take corporate or government funding, and we don't run advertising. So we're free to report on the important issues of the day from an independent perspective that doesn't have to abide by the interest of corporations.
And how did you come into journalism, Leah, and working for the Real News?
That's a very long story. I went to Guelph. I took biomedicine for schooling. And at some point towards the end of my third year, I realized that as I was writing my first thesis, that I loved writing about science more than I did doing the science. So I started writing a science column for The Ontarian. And at the same time, I was very political. I was doing a lot of activism. And I started writing also a column about human rights for The Peak. And at that point, I was working with the Human Rights Office of the CSA as well. So it was actually Guelph papers that got me into journalistic writing. And after writing for The Peak and for The Ontarian, I realized that this is really what I love doing. And when I finished my degree, I used a lot of the science I learned to write about science from a political perspective, such as the biomedical impacts of pollutants and what it means when there's a giant industrial project for the people who live next door to it. Eventually, I was started working more and more in politics and eventually went full circle to the Middle East where I grew up.
Wow. And for those who aren't aware, The Peak and The Ontarian are independent publications at the University of Guelph. Both are funded by the students. The Peak is an alternative magazine managed by a collective, lots of them being student volunteers. And The Ontarian is a weekly newspaper and is run by paid staff and volunteers. Also, I've watched snippets of your film, Seven Deadly Myths, and I heard you say that the main thread throughout the film emphasizes that the source of the strife within the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the collective denial. Can you expand on that?
Sure. So just a bit of context. I'm working on a documentary, and it's called Seven Deadly Myths. It's going to be a co-production with the British company Journeyman Pictures. And the focus of the film, sort of the plot, is the 1948 ethnic cleansing, the first war between Israel and the Palestinians that sparked the modern conflict that we have had for the past 63 years. And I realized while working on it, I originally was going to do a journalistic, very sort of academic documentary where I was going to investigate, you know, what we believe is a narrative and what was the facts on the ground and how it was discovered, etc. And I realized that even I interviewed all of the global experts on the issue, and I realized that even I was bored to tears watching it. So I wanted to look at the psychology behind it. And I realized that through my experience growing up as an Israeli in an Israeli settlement on the occupied West Bank, that even in my life, denial plays an enormous role in how I came to have a sort of across-the-board pro-Israeli, very Zionist, very strong agenda and political stance. And I really did discover, and this film looks into it more, that the collective denial of the narrative of the other is behind more or less what we're going through. And you can look at it from the point of view of interests, who benefits. But in terms of political economy, it can only go so far in explaining the conflict. But when you start to understand that we have two diametrically opposed national narratives, understandings of what we're doing here and why we're fighting, and more importantly, who they are and why they are fighting us, when you understand that not only do we have that, we deny the validity of the other because we have to have our own narrative, You understand why negotiations fail again and again, and now the peace process is dead. And why what we believe we're fighting for is based on our narrative. And our narrative is based on the denial of the narrative of the Palestinians. And the Palestinians have their own narrative. And their narrative denies ours. And it is by the work of Israelis who are crossing this border between the two narratives and deconstructing everything that these walls that we've created around our histories guard that I've managed to sort of come out of that way of thinking and start to really look at what is the psychological effect on me as an Israeli, as a settler, of everything that I believe. What is the psychological effect we're having as a nation? And so the film focuses on four people who were veterans in 1948, who themselves did the ethnic cleansing of 1948, were involved in various parts of the country, ethnically cleansing those parts of the country. And yet, after physically, personally, with their own hands, guns in their own hands, doing those things, managed to erase from their memories the existence of these events, these incidents where they killed and there was mass graves and there were mass expulsions and the Palestinians were made to march in a row towards Jordan. These violent images of theft and denial and then destroying 500 Palestinian villages, demolishing them and then building Jewish Israeli cities and towns on their ruins and then Judaizing their names. All of that process that happened in the 1948, 9, and 50s, they managed to suppress its very existence. So the point where my generation doesn't even know that that happened. And so it's more of an investigation, a psychological investigation of the concept of denial.
Mm-hmm. And this film you're working on, how when do you expect the finished product will come about?
Well... the question everyone hates to be asked. At this point, the schedule is such that we'll be going into production in September. Okay. And so we should be finished with the film in post-production about 6 months after that. So I'm hoping a year from now I'll be able to screen.
And I think I saw somewhere online that people can help fund, can provide donation to the project?
Certainly. If you go on www.7deadlymyths.com, there's information there.
How is Western media composed, and why is it important for the general public to know how corporate media operates and to be literate of corporate media? And with regards to what your film is about, why is it helpful to be media savvy in order to understand how media shapes how we are aware about what the oppressive Palestinian regime and the Israeli regime, what they are doing to the Palestinian people.
Right. I think it's very important for people to be media savvy for a couple of reasons. When you look at corporate mainstream coverage of the conflict, there are a couple of things that you see all the time. And people in my talks, they always talk about how they are biased. And the funny thing is that in Canada, if you look at the think tanks that analyze media bias when it comes to the Middle East, both in Canada, the two sides fighting each other, the more, quote, pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli, they both think that the media is completely biased in the other's direction. And to me, that only reinforces that the fact that I believe that bias is not the main problem. And the main problem is the conglomeration of corporate media into two gigantic corporations, to the point where when someone who works for CanWest reports about some sort of incident in the occupied territories, they're using the same source, and the same source is going to be reprinted in 30 papers across the country. They're getting the same story. And so what you get is mass information that is very concentrated. And where that source comes from becomes very, very important. And where most journalists base their sources from, most Canadian media outlets don't have journalists on the ground all over the world. And when something happens, they have to rely on Reuters or AP or AFP.
And can you explain what Reuters are?
Yeah, Reuters, Agence France-Presse, which is AFP, and Associated Press are three corporations that are... global news networks, agencies that have journalists, photojournalists, and video journalists all over the world. And what they do is they just report. When something happens, they go in, they film it, and they send it. And as a journalist, you go into work every morning, and you turn on your AP feed, or you turn on your Reuters feed, whatever your corporate media signed a contract with, And you look at what happened in the world and you decide what to write about. And that's how most Western media gets written.
So there's only three feeds that dictate what news is out there to major global agencies.
Yeah, the other option is if a journalist has their own personal connections on the ground, okay. But that's only possible if that person has been there, most likely. And most papers today can't afford to send their journalists abroad, mostly because of the decline of the funding of newspapers and for many other reasons. So you have not only a conglomeration of the corporation of media, you have a conglomeration of the story that the media reports. And what AP and Reuters and AFP cover, that is also very specific. So first of all, who dictates that? Those people, those reporters, those AP cameramen, they get their instruction from press releases from the government. So in Israel, they would get a press release from the Israeli government and they would, or the Palestinian Authority, and they would go to that place when they know that something will happen. They might have sources inside those governments. But very, very few of those agencies actually have people who are permanently based on the ground or who have serious connections to people on the ground to know when, for example, a nonviolent demonstration is about to happen or to know when things that are really impacting people's lives are happening. And so that result is that they only report this microcosm, this micro instance where someone gets killed or something gets major happens that all of the photojournalists all focus on and all report, and all over the world we're seeing the same images of the same one little thing, when that little one thing happens within a huge context of everything around it. And the other problem is that most of these agencies don't trust the local indigenous people, the people from that region, the native people, to report on their own societies. So you have if you have a journalist who's going to write analysis, that person is going to be flown in. That's going to be a foreigner. That's going to be someone who's going to be dropped into Baghdad or Kabul or Jerusalem for 2-3 weeks, maybe a month at a time. They're going to write their analysis as they learned it in a Western university, as they learned it in the Western context. And they're going to bring their world into the Middle East. They're not going to bring the Middle East into the Western world by having local people report on their own societies, what that impacts on them. And the bottom line in all of this is that you get, again, incidents without context. So when Al Jazeera commissioned a London-based think tank to do an investigation of what most English people believe, they found that more than 50% of British people didn't know that it was Israel that was occupying the West Bank. That the occupation, when people say occupation, they're referring to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. They either thought that it was the Palestinians that were occupying, or that they didn't know who was occupying whom. So something even so basic that it has such a prevalence on everything that is happening there, the reason we've been fighting for these 40 years about the occupation, people don't even know what we're talking about because there's no context to these incidents.
And so who benefits from the way that the corporate media operates in the way that they don't contextualize the news?
Well, that's a very important question. It's a very complicated answer that I don't know that I'm the best person to answer, but certainly the people who said the policy benefit, because when you have an ignorant mass, the ignorant masses will not hold you accountable to your policy. So for example, in the United States, there was another survey that was done and by Zogby International, which is a famous polling corporation there. And they found that now, in 2011, 2010, was the first year that a certain percentage, a significant percentage of Democratic voters understood that it was actually Israel who was stalemating the peace negotiations. When if you look at the facts, if you look at, for example, the leaks, the Palestine paper leaks, you see that Israel has again and again been stalemating this process, something that Palestinian journalists and commentators, for example, in the Electronic Intifada, in Ma'an News, in Al Jazeera, people who were from there who have been reporting about their own situation, they've been saying this for decades. And of course, the Western media doesn't report this. They don't report on the context of these negotiations. They only report about when they fall apart or when they're going to happen. And so the bottom line is when the masses don't know what's actually happening on the ground, you can lobby the government because you know that the government is not going to be held accountable for having taking positions and taking policies into effect that benefit you. So certainly the people who are shaping the policy around this benefit from having an ignorant mass. for sure.
Mm-hmm. How is Canada vital in drawing further the rift between the Palestinian people and the Israeli people?
Well, Canada has a long history of supplementing American imperialism. When you look at the U.S.'s involvement in Haiti, Canada trained the Haitian police that has a long track record of extrajudicial killings and torture. Canada is currently training the Afghan security forces, even though Canada's own military refused to hand over their own detainees to these forces that Canada is training because they're so notorious for torture. In the Middle East, Canada is training the Palestinian Authority forces. So the Canadian intelligence cooperation with Israel, Canada's military arms trade with Israel, Canadian political support for Israel, Canada's military involvement on the ground, troops on the ground in Israel, there are all ways that are very, very important that Canada is directly involved in the conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians. And most importantly, Canada plays a vital role in drawing further the rift inside the Palestinian political map by only funding Fatah-led projects, by being the first country to cut ties with Hamas, by being the second country in the world to put Hamas on the terrorist list, on its list of terrorist organizations after 9/11, even though Hamas had nothing to do with 9/11. And besides the political cover that Israel gives to the political choices of Israel, Canadian troops for years have been working inside the West Bank training Fatah paramilitary forces. So basically, the Canadian government picked one faction of the Palestinian people and decided to train them in how to be an army. And this paramilitary force gets their weapons from Jordan and Egypt. Canada also gives that force and that government that they selected to support $300 million Canadian. So the Canadian people are giving out of their taxes $300 million over the next 5 years, or now we're a year into this, to one faction of the Palestinian leadership that actually has no electoral mandate on the ground. So when they were elected, their election term expired 2 years ago. It expired twice over. They have absolutely no legal electoral right to be in power. And yet the Canadian government still funds them, supports them, trains their parliament military for Canadian interests. So Canada is very much on the ground being involved in shaping how this conflict is happening. And lastly, Canadian corporations are actually aiding this conflict by selling arms to Israel, by buying arms from Israel. Israeli drones are currently used in Afghanistan by the Canadian Army. And Canadian corporations build settlements. There are two Canadian corporations that are involved in illegal construction by international law of settlements inside the West Bank. Canadian corporations are also building the illegal wall between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. So Canada was never, is not, and cannot claim to be an honest broker when its money and its political weight is standing firmly behind Israel and Israeli policy.
Why should we care about how the conflicts that the West, including Canada, inflicts upon and support the world over? Like, why should we care about the psychological effects, the emotional effects of the war, of the conflict on the Palestinian people, on the Israeli people?
I think because the Canadian government, so the Harper government, the Canadian military and the Canadian corporations are involved in this conflict directly and also indirectly, by most of Canada's arms exports to Israel actually go through the U.S. So there's a direct way in which Canadians should care, because their money and their country is being used in dictating and shaping the future of the conflict in the Middle East. Like I said earlier, $300 million was pledged by the Canadian government to the Palestinian Authority. So that's $300 million Canadian taxpayer money that's being given to one faction of the Palestinians that has no electoral mandate. And the Canadian people need to be able to dictate what is done with their tax money. So you should care because it's your money and it's your government that's dictating a conflict that has a very important role to play in the entire geopolitical stability of the entire planet, and of course also in the Middle East. And what we're seeing now with the Arab revolutions all over the Arab world is that this is all coming around one after another, slowly back to Israel. And what happens in Israel-Palestine is very important to the future of the entire Middle East. And Canada siding itself with Israel, that's also going to have an important impact on what is going to be the future of that entire region.
Mm-hmm. What is the psychological effect of living under a military law, under an oppressive Israeli rule? The Palestinian Authority is no less oppressive, at least of what we know of Hamas's rule and the Fatah rule in the West Bank, but that's another interview.
Well, as an Israeli, it's very difficult for me to describe the psychological effect on the Palestinians of living for 40-some-odd years in an occupied area with a constant presence of an army, where you're not a citizen of any country. You don't have any rights. You are living under military law. So this is a very important point. When people talk about how they're offended by the term apartheid, when it comes to the West Bank, Israelis, so Israeli settlers and Palestinians who are living in the West Bank, literally live in the same area under two completely legal systems, different legal systems. Israeli settlers live in the West Bank under Israeli criminal law, Israeli regular citizen law, right? Palestinians live under military law. So what is the psychological effect of living for 40-some-odd years under a military law where if you want to build a balcony to your house, you have to go through 13 different agencies and permits and approvals to get a permit to build that balcony, where not a single water well has been approved to be drilled in the area that's occupied. So you don't have any rights. You don't have any opportunity to change your situation. Your employment, the future of your economy is completely dependent on the whim of Israel's political situation. And of course, living surrounded by a concrete wall, in some places it's a fence, but surrounded by a wall, so not being able to go anywhere, not being able to travel, that has enormous psychological impacts. And when it comes to the actual conflict, the actual violent conflict, Israel's attack on Gaza in 2008-2009 has had a huge effect on the children, on the psychological effect of the children in Gaza. And the Gaza mental health community health program, I don't remember the acronym, they do very important work on the ground by working with children and youth and helping them cope with the mass devastation that happened at the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, that led to 1,400 civilians and militants, 1,400 Palestinians being killed, and that demolished huge parts of Gaza. And what they found there is that 95% of children in Gaza have severe anxiety. And more than 60% are experiencing severe effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, to the point where 24.7% of Gaza's children don't see a point in living. They want to die as martyrs. Now, what does that mean, dying as martyrs? Because something that is often used to perpetuate the conflict is this notion that Palestinians are training their children to hate, etc. When you look at that statistics, a quarter of Gaza's children don't see a point in living because they know that they will either be killed or someone they love will be killed, or they will lose their house, they will be demolished, they might get bombed. When a quarter of Gaza's children don't want to live, when they ask those same children, do you want to be involved in the national struggle? 0.1% said yes. So 99.9% of Gaza's children don't want to be involved in the national struggle. That means that they don't want to be terrorists. They don't want to die suicide bombings. They just don't see a point in living because what they've seen their entire existence, their entire life, is living under occupation, behind a wall, completely isolated from the world. And one thing that I hear again and again in places where there's a lot of attacks on Palestinians, like in Nablus, in East Jerusalem, in Hebron, the Palestinians, that, you know, I'm interviewing them, I'm reporting on what they're experiencing, and they're saying, you come here, you come, you film, you see, you show this to the world, and yet nothing changes. Why doesn't the world care? So you know that there's an enormous injustice done upon you, and yet nothing is changing. And most of the world's perception is still very negative towards the Palestinians. Even though some things have changed in the past 5-10 years in terms of people in the world being aware of what a Palestinian is, still the large perception, especially since 9/11, of Palestinians is extremely negative. So you feel that there's an enormous injustice against you. You're living in this occupation. You're deprived of your rights. Most of the people there are living also as refugees. And yet the world has this skewed perception of who you are. So having said all that, that is just scratching the very, very tip of the iceberg of all of the psychological, social effects that are very important on this, of what it's like to live under occupation. And there are Palestinian NGOs all over the West Bank and Gaza who do incredible work in reporting what effect that actually has. And I would really encourage people listening to go and research this, because I think it's one of the most important things. And this is what, besides my work for The Real News as a Middle East correspondent, the film that I'm doing separately, that's what it's looking at. And that's the reason I got involved in journalism, because I wanted to understand the psychological effect as an Israeli this had on me. And this is the reason for why I'm even doing all this.
You grew up in Israel, and in all your life you hadn't ever tried to get to know or befriend a Palestinian until you came to study at the University of Guelph. How did your perspective on the conflict change after befriending someone who identifies as being a Palestinian? And also, you once said something interesting about the concrete wall. I remember you saying once that a lot of people who identify as being Israeli don't even know much about Palestinians, but they are socialized to believe since a very young age that Palestinians are people to hate. Talk about that.
Sure. And before we started building a concrete wall, we have had for decades a mental wall that really separates us from them. And I grew up in an Israeli settlement inside the occupied West Bank. So I met the people that are the Palestinians, but I didn't know the term Palestinian. I didn't know that these people are the Palestinians. In our mind, they're all Arabs, and the Arabs are just a monolith of Arabic people. They have, you know, dozens of their own countries. I don't understand why they're here, etc., etc. The stripping of the Palestinian narrative of their history, their specific identity, their national identity, etc. So it wasn't until I came to Canada after leaving Israel, and I lived here for a number of years, that I actually met someone who said, "I'm a Palestinian." And I said, "But what is that?" And he started explaining. And that's when I first time in my life had a conversation with a Palestinian and realized that I'm meeting for the first time a Palestinian. So there's an enormous wall. And when I was back in the Middle East working with The Real News, my editor from The Real News, Paul Jay, he came to visit the Middle East, and he wanted me to take him to the place where I grew up. So we went to my settlement, Ariel, and we stood at the highest point in the settlement. And so we're standing at the very edge of it. And in front of you is this sprawling, beautiful settlement of white houses with red roofs, all clustered together in this sort of amoeba giant thing. It's one of the biggest settlements in the West Bank. And all around it, there are these beautiful hills of olive groves. And somewhere in the far, far distance, in this gorgeous landscape, is the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. And we're standing there, and he's saying, "Well, why don't you introduce yourself and say, you know, I'm so-and-so, I work for The Real News." So he turns on the camera, and I take the microphone, and I say, "Hello, I'm Leah Tarachansky. I'm the Middle East correspondent for The Real News." And all of a sudden, I'm interrupted by this loud, "Allahu Akbar." And it's the call to prayer. It happens every day. And it's especially loud at 4:45 when it happens for the last prayer of the day. And I'm standing there in front of the camera, and I finally realize that it's the first time in my life that I hear it. You know, I spent, you know, all these years growing up in an Israeli settlement in the middle of the West Bank, surrounded by Palestinian villages, and I have never heard the call to prayer. That is how far the denial process goes in raising us to completely make them invisible. They are not part of our consciousness. Their struggle is not part of our lexicon. Their physical presence, we don't see them, we don't hear them, and so their narrative doesn't exist. It doesn't matter. And when it comes down to reaching across the divide that separates our different people, it's next to impossible when you don't see the humanity, the history, the importance of the other. And it's when you deconstruct these mental walls that we have of each other. And I'm sure you know that most Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have never seen an Israeli other than a soldier. They've never seen a Jewish person go to the store and buy some gum. They've never seen Jewish kids playing around in the mud. The majority of Palestinians have never seen an Israeli other than in the context of the occupation. And so they have a mental wall of what we look like, what we do. I mean, I heard a journalist make a joke about how she was somewhere in the West Bank, and a Palestinian, she's an Israeli journalist, a Jewish journalist, and a Palestinian asked her if Jews have the same sex organs as other humans, because they have absolutely no understanding of what a Jewish person is or what an Israeli person is. So until you break down the concrete walls and the mental walls that separate us, and I think media is an instrumental part of this because most of us get most of our information from news, until you break down those walls, you're not going to be able to reach across that divide and actually have a serious conversation.
What do you want to leave listeners with? What kind of message? How can they contribute to giving healthy support to the Palestinian people? Like, we have the boycott and divestment sanctions campaign that we talked about earlier in the show.
Sure. Well, I think that the real news came about in a very sort of healthy way as a response to what mainstream journalists saw as problems within corporate media, abandoned that model and started something that counteracts, that balances, that fixes that problem. And what we're trying to do by establishing a Middle East bureau for the real news is hire a Palestinian journalist to work alongside an Israeli journalist to cover their society from inside for a broad international audience so that people get that context, that other side of that, so you understand what a bureaucratic occupation looks like, what an administrative occupation looks like. But we are not the only independent media that is going to be on the ground, and we've been working on the ground for a while now. There are Palestinian independent media organizations, such as the Alternative Information Center, which is a joint Israeli-Palestinian center. There's the IMEMC, the International Middle East Media Center, which is a very important resource, the IMEMC. You have independent Palestinian journalists, cameramen, photojournalists on the ground. And there's a million ways you can participate in amplifying their voice so that you get that other side of that picture, the other side of that curtain that portrays Palestinians as just eternal victims, as just these people who are constantly either suffering, or Palestinians as these people who are just violent and attacking. So I think media activism is very important, supporting independent media, supporting the real news. I think that's also very, very important. There are on the ground struggles in the Palestinian territories and in Israel. There's a growing boycott movement inside Israel. There's also a growing nonviolent resistance movement inside Israel that crosses that border. People that take the risk, they sacrifice, their future within that system of Israeli society in order to fight for a just peace alongside Palestinians by going into the West Bank, facing that army side by side in real solidarity against what they see is causing the conflict. But I think the most important thing that Canadians can do is to influence Canadian policy. Because Canada, as I've said earlier, is very involved in this conflict. Canadian tax money is very involved in this conflict. So if Canadians really care about how their foreign policy influences this conflict, they really need to look at effective ways they can challenge where their tax money and where their politicians use that tax money. So I think that's one very important point. And of course, forcing politicians to be more accountable and forcing politicians to take serious and courageous positions when it comes to the Middle East, rather than, blanket support.
Thank you for your work, Leah, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Migrant Matters Radio on Guelph's community radio station, 93.3 FM. I'm Mary, and I have just been speaking with Leah Tarachansky. Leah is an independent journalist and works as the Middle East news correspondent for The Real News. She is currently finishing up production on her debut documentary called Seven Deadly Myths.